The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Given the remarkable amount of attention the dark side has received, I assume you know about the topic of the book, but you may not know about Jane Mayer. Ms. Mayer is a Washington-based staff writer for The New Yorker, specializing in political and investigative reporting. Before that, she was a senior writer and front-page editor for The Wall Street Journal, as well as the journal's first female White House correspondent. She is the co-author of two earlier best-selling and critically acclaimed works of nonfiction, Landslide, The Unmaking of the President, 1984 to 1988, and Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. Jane Mayer was also awarded the prestigious Guggenheim Fellowship in connection with The Dark Side. And as Bob Herbert wrote in his recent column, The Dark Side is essential reading for those who think they can stand the truth. Please welcome Jane Mayer.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome. I'm delighted to be with you here tonight. I don't know if I can live up to the expectations I saw in something called the Philly Fun Guide. With a topic like this, I don't know, but I guess everyone's got their own idea of what fun is. So anyway, I wanted to say first that it seems particularly fitting that this talk would take place here in Philadelphia, because as you residents of the city know better than I do, this is the city where the essential character of America as a nation of laws, not men, as John Adams famously put it, was forged during the Constitutional Convention in 1787. And it's here in the city that the framers of the Constitution separated the federal government into three branches in the hopes that the balance of power would become a permanent check on tyranny. And they were especially intent on curbing the president's power to wage war. They knew from historic example that there were short-term benefits for politicians waging wars, particularly for the commander-in-chief, but sometimes ruinous long-term costs in terms of blood and treasure. The Constitution that the framers wrote that sultry summer of 1787, more than any other document, unites us as a people. And we've got no state religion, no shared ethnic identity, but thanks to the wisdom of the founding fathers who gathered here, America has held together in good times and bad by a common belief in the supremacy of the law. My topic here tonight is the radical challenge to America's tradition of the rule of law that's been posed by the war on terror. In particular, I want to talk about the devastating, unintended consequences of the Bush administration's embrace of extra-legal tactics that would have been unthinkable before 9/11 and which likely would have been unthinkable to the framers of the Constitution. These tactics include the secret capture and indefinite extrajudicial detention of suspects without charges in a global war in which victory has never been defined. These tactics also include the snatching of uncharged suspects all around the world for transport to hidden prisons, an American program known as Extraordinary Rendition, but which a former CIA official described to me as Kidnap Inc. And for the first time in American history, the Bush administration's tactics also included the deliberate use of state-sanctioned and government-inflicted physical and psychological cruelty aimed at coercing suspects into making confessions. It's by now a cliche to say that 9/11 changed everything, but I think very few people fully grasp that among the most momentous things that changed was that after 9/11, America was transformed into a country in which torture is now the law of the land in all but name. The subject of my book, The Dark Side, is how this happened and whether it matters. I was on a hugely popular radio show just yesterday where the talk show host said to me when I came on the air, well, if you put what he will call his private parts in a vise, he said, I'd sure talk, so what's wrong with that? Why shouldn't we do it to terrorists? Should we care what happens to suspects who likely have no scruples about attacking us in the most heinous ways? Why take the high road? Does it matter? When I was researching this book, I had the honor of having a lunch with the late President prudential historian Arthur Schlesinger, Jr. in New York, and I put this question to him. Schlesinger was a political liberal, a defender of civil liberties, but he also admired robust foreign policies. So when I asked him how serious the consequences of the Bush administration's resort to torture and other extra-legal tactics were, I wasn't sure what he would say. After a considerably long pause, and after finishing a mouthful of steak tartare, washed down with a nip of Bombay gin, I might add, he looked over the rims of his spectacles, and he said without a flicker of doubt, "No position taken has done more damage to the American reputation in the world ever." He described the Bush administration's extra-legal counterterrorism program as presenting, quote, "the most sustained, dramatic, and radical challenge to the rule of law in American history." With the hindsight of 7 years, other experts have begun to describe other ways in which these programs have damaged America. The use of coerced confessions has polluted the intelligence community's understanding of terrorism by filling it with unreliable information. A former top CIA official who was close to George Tenet, the former director of the CIA, told me privately, 90% of what we got from this program was crap. I'll go more into that later. The use of coerced confessions under conditions that shock the conscience of the court, as the lawyers put it, is right now impeding the prosecution of alleged serious al-Qaeda figures. The government was recently forced to drop charges down in Guantanamo against the detainee named Mohammed al-Qahtani, who is thought to be the 20th hijacker, because the case was so tainted by the tortuous interrogation he went through, they knew it would be thrown out even in Guantanamo. Even in the trial underway right now in Guantanamo, that of Osama bin Laden's driver, Salim Hamdan, the military judge last week had to throw out evidence because it was extracted under unacceptable conditions. And Hamdan really did not go through anything particularly difficult compared to most. Hamdan had been hooded and shackled and kept in isolation for days. And when he was questioned, a photograph showed he was held in a hammer hold by U.S. soldiers at Bagram Air Force Base. The very real possibility exists now that the abuse that we subjected Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to, the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks himself, will turn any future trial of him into a trial of America, allowing one of the most unrepentant, megalomaniacal mass murderers in the history of the country to portray himself as a victim. Meanwhile, the image of America as torturing Muslims has become the single best recruiting tool for radical jihadis. Virtually every terrorist website features photos of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and the like. America's reputation has become so debased internationally, even our allies have recoiled. Great Britain very recently declared it could not trust our word not to torture and therefore could not assist in some counter-terrorist operations with us. Canada, of all places, on a roster of rogue nations that torture. It's gotten so that instead of leading the world in fighting for human rights, corrupt America is joined by corrupt and repressive states such as Egypt, Sudan, and Zimbabwe, all of which have justified their own brutality in recent years by citing the American example. A recent study by the Pew Foundation found that public opinion in only two countries in the world at this point supports us in the war on terror, India and Russia. Meanwhile, bin Laden and his co-conspirator Ayman Zawahiri are still at large, and according to the most recent national intelligence estimate by the U.S. intelligence community, the percentage of young Muslims who identify themselves as radical jihadis is on the rise. The study warns that if trends continue in this direction, threats to American interests will increase worldwide. So how did we get here? Well, it's tempting to lay all the blame for America's descent into torture on the Bush administration. It was, after all, Vice President Cheney who more or less announced publicly that America was breaking with the values of the Enlightenment and embracing those of the Dark Ages when he spelled out on the first Sunday after 9/11 during an interview with Tim Russert on Meet the Press that from then on, to win the war on terror, America would have to work on what he called the dark side, the title of my book. The rest of his quote was, "We've got to spend some time in the shadows in the intelligence world. A lot of what needs to be done here will have to be done quietly, using sources and methods that are available to our intelligence agencies if we're going to be successful. That's the world these folks operate in. It's going to be vital for us to use any means at our disposal, basically, to achieve our objectives." For an exceedingly secretive politician, Cheney actually revealed quite a lot in that one comment. Between the lines, if you look at it carefully, he was announcing that this would be a new kind of war fought in a new kind of way, in secret, and with the mindset that the ends which were safeguarding America justified virtually any means, including fighting terror with terror, if that's what it took. As he put it, we were moving out of our own world and into the world that these people operate in. Cheney's both a fascinating and an easy target. It's convenient to lay all blame on a man whose own wife jokes that the frequent comparisons between him and Darth Vader humanize him. But a more honest account of how America lost its way in fighting the war on terror, I think, would find most of us at least a little complicit in supporting the Faustian bargain that the country made after 9/11. Speaking for myself as a native New Yorker, with a sister who lives literally across the street from the World Trade Center, and as a resident now with my family of the Washington area, in other words, as someone whose life and family spanned both of the cities that were targeted by al-Qaeda, I know that in those first frightening months, I was not particularly sympathetic to the claims that the Bush administration was being too tough. I vaguely remember news stories about detainees in Afghanistan being suffocated alive in shipping containers, and I don't recall that it bothered me terribly. I also don't remember feeling especially perturbed when John Walker Lind was captured and bound naked with duct tape and made to wear a sign that said shithead. Most of us probably felt like Hillary Clinton, who called him a traitor before he was even charged, let alone tried. Interestingly, it was President Bush who showed more empathy. He called him a poor, lost fellow. He also wondered aloud what to do with him. It was a deeply frightening time. I believe many fatefully bad choices were made by the Bush administration in the war on terror, but I also think that the problems posed by the terrorists who take advantage of an open society like ours are extremely difficult. Part of what I tried to do in the dark side, therefore, is to start at the beginning and show how difficult the challenge was and how unprepared for it the Bush administration was. Inside the White House, just after 9/11, there was an effort to project a mood of calm and control to the country, but in truth, the place was close to panic. Everyone expected additional attacks. There were people at the CIA who were told that, don't go to New York this weekend, it's going to come, this is the one. And it happened, you know, every few weeks. There were false alarms in the White House, a lot of them, and there was one in particular on October 18th in which Cheney himself thought he might have been exposed fatally to weapons of mass destruction. They had a special sensor in the White House. It went off. It said that either biological, chemical, or radiological weapons were in the Situation Room. It was in this atmosphere that the Bush administration devised a new system of law to vanquish what they said was a new enemy. They unleashed the CIA to launch the most ambitious covert program since the Cold War, and maybe ever. President Bush secretly authorized death squads to kill or capture and interrogate suspects in a clandestine global war spanning 80 countries. This was new territory. The CIA had never been jailers before. The CIA had also never interrogated people much. They had very little experience in this. It was the military and the FBI that interrogated suspects in this country. The CIA knew how to polygraph people. They do it to their own employees at least once a year, particularly when they talk to reporters. but they knew how to debrief defectors. But coercive interrogations were something new for them. They were amateurs, and it soon showed. They thought that torture would be a shortcut. They asked all the wrong people for advice. When we were first hit, they turned to some of the repressive, undemocratic Arab allies and said, so what do you do to your people? they also turned to a secret military program called the SEER program, which is just a phenomenally weird story, but it provided a blueprint for much of the torture program in America. It's a program in which the special forces are trained in case they ever are captured. They're subjected to a program of mock torture based on communist methods. And after 9/11, the people who ran that program became the people who designed America's program. So it was based on everything that we always thought was torture before 9/11, and it was done by our enemies. And believe it or not, after 9/11, they actually turned to Fox TV's fantasy show 24 for advice on how to interrogate people. Down in Guantanamo, the top lawyer, Diane Beaver, said that when the interrogators were stuck on what to do next, they actually copied Jack Bauer. They watched the show down there all the time, and as she said, they were big fans. I have to say that I have interviewed the creator of 24, and his name is Joel Surnow, and I can assure you he knows absolutely nothing about Islamic fundamentalism or about the laws of interrogation or about the law in general. He also knows nothing about the difference between fighting a war with honor and fighting one dishonorably. He's the creator of a great, you know, thriller show, but what he knows about is how to get ratings, not how to get the truth. Meanwhile, after taking the brakes off of the CIA, President Bush also cleared all the rules of the road. President Bush declared the Geneva Conventions did not apply to the terror suspects. This seems sensible to some. Terrorists don't seem to be prisoners of war necessarily. It had been done in the Reagan administration in regards to the PLO. But unlike the Reagan administration, the Bush administration also declared that the terrorists were not criminals. So they took them outside of both known systems of law, both the international system of law and the domestic system of law. The result was, as the British law lord Stein has put it famously, they created a legal black hole. And the Bush administration assumed that, meanwhile, all of the enhanced powers that go with becoming commander-in-chief, but they gave the detainees absolutely none of the rights. Some of the consequences became clear immediately. Without the Geneva Conventions, there was no screening process for the prisoners they were taking. The Geneva Conventions have something called Article 5 hearings, and we used them in the last Gulf War, and there were some 1,200 such hearings, and I guess a couple hundred of the people who went through them were considered prisoners of war, and the rest were determined to be bystanders and innocent and let go. But in the War on Terror, they got rid of that rudimentary due process by getting rid of the Geneva Conventions. And instead, bounty hunters rounded people up, and many mistakes were made. As I tell in the book, by the summer of 2002, the administration was concerned because they weren't getting good intelligence out of the prisoners down in Guantanamo. So they sent down an Arab-speaking CIA expert who knew a lot about Islamic radicalism. He went down to Cuba to see what was wrong. He interviewed several dozen of the prisoners, and he came back with bad news. He told the White House that after interviewing the detainees, he believed that approximately one-third were innocent people who had been mistakenly held. They had nothing to do with al-Qaeda. When he told the general who was in charge of Guantanamo this at the time, Michael Dunleavy, who's actually a judge in Pennsylvania, in Erie, Dunleavy said he thought actually it probably wasn't a third of the people who were mistakes. He thought it was probably closer to 50%. With this news, this news reached the top of the White House, where John Bellinger III, the top lawyer for the National Security Council, was very concerned about the report. And he went to talk to Alberto Gonzalez, then the White House counsel, about it. Bellinger, along with a former general in the Army named John Gordon, hoped that they could do something to rectify the situation. But when they got to the meeting with Gonzalez, they found themselves joined by, oddly, Vice President Cheney's lawyer, David Addington, who is a character who looms very large in this book and in this period of history. David Addington is a very conservative and belligerent personality who basically said of him, nobody stands to his right. And when these two who were, you know, scarcely to be described as wusses, considering one was a former general in the Army, talked about the need to maybe reassess who we were holding down in Guantanamo, Addington was absolutely furious. He said, this decision's been made by the president. We're not going back on it. Bellinger and Gordon said, but we're Americans. We're not supposed to imprison innocent people. They got nowhere, absolutely nowhere. So that's a pattern that I tried to write a lot about in this book, which was dissent was greeted with anger and that those who dissented were soon excommunicated from the inner circles. Instead, the decisions were made by a tiny clique of people, five lawyers basically, who called themselves the War Council and who did the legal work for the most part on behalf of Vice President Cheney. I'd like to tell you that things got better, but after the situation in Guantanamo where they knew they were holding people who were being falsely accused and detained, some things got worse. They began to pick up some innocent people and rendition them. I tell the story of Maher Arar, a Canadian engineer who was picked up at JFK Airport coming home from a family holiday, and because his name seemed connected in some way to somebody on a watch list at the U.S., he was sent by a private Gulf jet to Syria by the United States, where he spent a year being tortured. Even the Syrians, who are not known as soft on terrorists, after a year concluded he had no links to terrorism and was not a terrorist, and they had to let him go. There's the story of Khalid al-Masri, who is a German citizen who is a car salesman who was renditioned by mistake by the United States to Afghanistan, to a dungeon. Right from the start, there were people involved in the rendition program at the CIA who had a strange feeling about him. They didn't think he acted like a terrorist. And yet they held him for 5 months. He lost something like 60 or 70 pounds and, practically lost his mind. I mean, it's just an incredible story that they would... I try to tell what was going on inside the CIA at this point. They had to finally... Some of the lawyers there had to use subterfuge to overpower a very powerful woman who was in charge of the rendition program, who just wouldn't listen. She kept saying something seemed fishy about him. She didn't like the people that he knew. There seemed to be something wrong about him. His passport checked out. They had zero evidence, and he was just a case of mistaken identity. And then there's the case of the people who we put through coercive interrogation, who in the course of this gave up false confessions that led us in the wrong direction, the most fateful of which is someone named Ibn Sheikh al-Libi. He was picked up not too long after 9/11, first by the FBI, which felt that they were succeeding in getting him to talk without using coercion, but the CIA, in kind of a custody struggle, got a hold of him and sent him to Egypt, where he was brutalized. And while he was being brutalized, there's a big Senate report about this, and he was being asked questions about things he didn't even understand, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. This was before the war, and the government was looking for evidence that would justify the war. And so even though he didn't really understand what bioweapons were, he started saying, of course they had them. And he also started talking about what else they wanted to hear, which were links between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. A year after the war, they went back to him and asked what happened, because he completely recanted. And he said, I had to tell them something because they were killing me. By then, his information had worked its way into a speech from President Bush, and also into Colin Powell's momentous speech at the UN that really pushed us into the war. Nobody told Powell. They already had some questions about the veracity of this particular detainee, and nobody even warned him about it. So all this sounds horrible, I know. I get questioned all the time from my family and other people about how can you stand to focus on such a depressing topic? I have to say, I don't know if it says something awful about me, but I didn't actually find this subject depressing. First of all, as a reporter, it gave me such a role to play. I felt I was doing what reporters really are supposed to do, which is informing the country about what our government is doing. And the other thing that the reason I wanted to take some of these stories that have appeared in The New Yorker before and weave them into a seamless history here, and one is that part of the story was never visible in the regular press, which is the people that reporters like myself talk to get these stories. There was a hidden war going on inside the White House, and tremendous people involved in pushing back and standing up for the rule of law and saying, we're better than this, we don't need to do this. The military lawyers were amazing. The FBI officers, some of them absolutely refused to have anything to do with the torture program, and in fact, there were several of them suggested that the CIA officers be arrested for what they were doing. The FBI then withdrew completely from the war on terror for quite a long period. There were also lawyers right in the Bush White House who fought and risked their careers and were penalized for the arguments they made. And they, in these small ways, these are real acts of courage. I really admired these people, and I wanted to tell their story too, because I think that it's really pretty inspiring. So some of that is in this book. And then finally, I just wanted to address the question that I've been getting a lot, which is, where are we now? What happens next? And I wanted to, in thinking about that, tell you one of the quotes that I think is best in this book, which is from a man named Philip Zelikow, who was a historian at the University of Virginia, and he was the legal counselor to Condoleezza Rice. And he, after trying to correct some of these policies, went back down to academia and was taking stock and said, over time, he thinks people will think of this much as the way we do the Japanese internment during World War II. And he said he thought it happened for many of the same reasons in much the same way. And the way he put it was that fear and anxiety were exploited by zealots and fools. Pretty tough thing to say when you've actually been a member of this administration and on the record. So that would be, I think, a good case scenario if it ends that way, with us thinking this is another one of those blots in history that happen when America overreacts and the fear of the politics of fear get the better of us and we correct it. That would be, you know, the best outcome. The question is it over? Will it end? Are we going to say this is just a limited engagement in the world of torture or not? And for that, I want to return to Philadelphia, which was a famous quote from Benjamin Franklin, who was asked when he was leaving the Constitutional Convention by a lady, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" And he replies, "A republic, if you can keep it." So I think it's up to the American people. So. We're going to take questions.
Yes. Most of you know how this works. If you put your hand up, we will call on you. Please wait for the microphone. I can see we already have a lot of questions. One question per person in the form of a question, please. Gentleman in the white here.
You made the point even more strongly, I think, this morning in the interview with Marty Moscoen, that the extra-legal shenanigans of the Bush administration were essentially the consequence of 9/11, more or less. I think there are, however, indications that the Bush administration has been playing fast and loose with the law in other areas. For instance, what came out yesterday that Monica Goodling and others, you know, played games with appointments in the Justice Department.
Sir, so, can you circle around to the question, please?
Yeah. So, Meg, I think, can you put this in a larger context? Don't you think it should be put in a larger context that the Bush administration, I think, is generally speaking,
breaking lots of laws,
has been.
I mean, they're very, very much related. I think that the Bush administration has looked at the law not as something that is authentic in its own right, the rule of law. I think they've looked at it as an impediment to a large extent, and I think they've looked at it as a means to an end, the end being advancing their political agenda. So I think that's what you basically see in the Justice Department. And thus, they used a tiny office in the Justice Department, a very powerful tiny office, the Office of Legal Counsel, to write up a number of legal memoranda to justify this torture program. And, you know, I mean, stretching the law to a point where Harold Coe, the dean of Yale Law School, said, you know, that some of those opinions were the single most erroneous opinions he'd ever seen in his life. So it was law was a very malleable thing in this administration, and I guess still is.
You know what, just to follow up on that, can you talk a little bit about the OLC and the role and how that functions?
The Office of Legal Counsel. The Office of Legal Counsel is kind of like a mini Justice Department for the executive branch. It's only got about, I guess, 40 lawyers, and but they can issue opinions on what's legal for the executive branch to do. And during right after 9/11, John Yoo was the deputy in that office who had the most power and the most knowledge of the laws of war, and he churned out. He's also sort of a protean writer. He's now a professor at Berkeley Law School. He churned out one secret memo after another that very much served the Bush administration's agenda on wanting to take the gloves off on terrorists. And famously, the torture memo was one of the ones that he wrote. And these memos, if you read them, they've been described by Anthony Lewis as kind of reading like what mob lawyers do for mobsters. They give you a complete path around criminality. So they basically take a crime and then show you how to evade it. And there was one memo that just came out this last week that the ACLU got in their FOIA program. And it found, it was written by John Yoo, and it said that you can't really be found guilty of torture if you torture someone, but you're not, your main aim is not causing pain. So if you can argue that your intent is pure and that the pain was just a byproduct, then you're probably not guilty of torture. Now, these kinds of this sort of sophistry is everywhere coming out of that Justice Department in this program. And those opinions were known as golden shields over at the CIA because people who were involved in the program, some people thought this would protect them from criminal repercussions. But those golden shields got withdrawn by Jack Goldsmith, one of the lawyers in the administration towards the end of 2004. And what he did was, I think, one of those acts of courage, basically, to say, even though he's a conservative lawyer in the administration, this is who he. You can't run a government following these kinds of phony legal arguments.
Thank you. Another question. Gentleman in the green here.
Maybe you can cheer me up because you said you're looking at this in some sort of a positive fashion, whereas I find it very depressing. But I think back to many years ago, I witnessed very similar things with the Nixon administration. And the thing that was kind of nice about that was ultimately the story came out. We got to the bad actors. It just doesn't seem to be playing out here. I mean, the one hope I had a few years back was when they got Scooter, and I thought back to that instance where the judge laid out a very stiff sentence against one of the Watergate break-ins, and they all started crying. Well, of course, Scooter got a nice thing. He got pardoned a few days, or whatever the proper word is, a few days later. So it really hasn't come out, and they're doing such a great job of stonewalling. They seem like they have all the justice and legal positions fully stacked. It just seems like a really rigged game. Do you see it ever playing out differently?
I think we're right at a potential turning point, depending on who's in the White House next and what they want to do. There are a lot of documents that people like me can't get. I always say I have subpoena envy. I can't get a hold of a lot of things. And it's true, though, but the next president can open up the books, basically, which is really what I would like to see and find out. I mean, even the interrogation records, but there are criminal investigations going on now. There's a criminal investigation into who destroyed the videotapes and why that the CIA had of people being waterboarded. I agree. It's very frustrating because that seems to have taken an awful long time, given how obvious that situation is. You've got both of the Republican and the Democrat who were the leaders of the 9/11 Commission. Wrote a piece in the New York Times saying, this is obstruction of justice. We asked for all information, and the CIA destroyed the tapes. So I think there's a lot out there. And again, I have to believe that the difference is maybe they are better defended because of the whole issue of terrorism being something that people are afraid of challenging. But I also think that the public's been quieter than during Watergate. I mean, I was just... coming on the scene watching that when I guess I was just in college, and with those hearings were on all day long on television, and everybody was following it and talking about it. I do feel it's building, though, again, to try not to depress you. There have been more and more hearings up on the Hill. Congress is asking questions, and I think the public's paying more attention. I've gotten an unbelievable reaction to this book that I never imagined, which is just incredibly gratifying. And people seem, part of it is it's a hard story to understand. So I've been trying to piece it together in this book so people can really see it in its enormity. And it does seem to be having some impact. So,
Oh, some more questions right here in the second round.
Thank you. I read a lot of the books that have come out about Iraq War and about the Bush administration. I'm still not clear in my mind exactly how much Bush set this all in motion, or how much he's oblivious to it, or somewhere in between. Do you have any sense of...
Wouldn't it be great to know? Yeah. you know, this administration, I've covered all of them since Reagan anyway. This one is just so secretive. It's incredibly difficult to get inside. And, you know, one of the key questions about the torture program is whether they kept some of the details from Bush in order to give him deniability or not. I think nobody I know, and I interviewed so many people, nobody believes that Cheney missed a single detail. He really was up to his eyeballs in this, I think, and so was Addington. And but the president himself, you know, it's funny, he keeps disappearing from the frame when you're trying to write about him and report on him. He certainly was in favor of this program, and I think in some ways you can see him as reverting to his prep school role as the cheerleader, and Cheney's kind of the quarterback. And you know, there are certainly a number of meetings he's in where details of these things are being discussed. So he's not completely ignorant of it.
Moving back, gentleman right there.
I have a great deal of trouble with all of this with the U.S. Congress. This went on for many years, and it's hard to believe that they did not know this was going on. Why didn't Congress do something?
Well, I think, you know, there's again, it's not a popular point because I try to touch on this issue of complicity, and I think that the guilt is more widespread than just those people who did it and the rest of us thought it was wrong. I think that the country let it happen and didn't want to know more, and because the country was silent, I think Congress had no backbone, and that's not an excuse because they're supposed to be leaders. And they should have asked questions, and they should have stood up. And when they did, Richard Durbin at one point did, and he wound up having to apologize. I don't know if you remember, he likened Guantanamo to the kinds of things that you read about Nazi Germany, and he was jumped on so hard that he had to go to the Senate floor and apologize tearfully. So there were a lot of political downsides for the politicians, and in some ways it took McCain, because of his, you know, his moral standing and experiences, having been a prisoner of war himself, and you know, nobody could challenge his patriotism, and having been tortured, to finally come out and say, you know, that it's not about them, it's about us, and this is wrong, and that anybody will. He broke when he was interrogated, and he knew that anybody, you know, most anybody will break, and they'll say whatever they need to make the pain stop. And it took him finally stepping up to it, and he, you know, he gets a lot of credit for stepping up to it, and I do give him some credit for it, but he could have stepped up to it a lot earlier, and he was being begged to do so, actually, and by some of the NGOs, the human rights groups. And he told them, I need some cover. And what they finally did was, one group in particular, Human Rights First, lined up tons of really highly esteemed military figures. The military were great, and who basically stood up and spoke out first. And when they signed a petition and everything else and delivered it to McCain, that's only then did he really feel that he could speak up. But they were spineless. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And I interviewed Chuck Schumer not so very long ago and was asking him, why don't you talk about civil liberties issues? Why don't you talk about torture? And he said, my constituents don't care about it. And so that was his excuse. It's a Democrat from a liberal, you know, district.
Right here in the second row, and we'll keep moving back. Sir, the mic is on your right.
I've been most struck when you've spoken of top-level officials in the White House knowing in some detail what interrogations were going on and approving specifics in real time, and that, in its turn, possibly exposing top-level officials in the White House to criminal liability in the future. Could you say some more about that in this intimate little group here?
Well, I think if they have not destroyed all the records exist that would name who were in the rooms at the time that these interrogations took place and step by step exactly what they did. They did. This program was very bureaucratized, and when somebody who was a CIA interrogator wanted to do one thing more, add some extra sleep deprivation, or belly slap someone. Every time they wanted to do something extra, they had to ask Langley. There was cable traffic that went back and forth between Virginia and Afghanistan, or wherever they were holding these people in the black sites. All of this exists, or did exist. I don't know if it's still there. I mean, I think, you know, this is the kind of thing where you'd want to try to get whoever is in next to preserve the records fast. But it does, it did exist. And, you know, one of the things I've been really wanting to know, I have to say, in particular, is the names of the doctors who are involved in this program. Because so many of the detainees' statements, when you finally see them, describe being checked out by doctors and not helped by doctors. I mean, they will be, a detainee will, you know, have their blood pressure taken and all their sort of vital statistics, and they're all photographed naked also. I mean, so there's got to be a tremendous archive of photographs. But the doctors, you know, these detainees would be begging for help. And there was a situation where a number of them were literally cracking their heads into the walls, and somebody there, the Khalid El-Masri, the German car dealer, said to a doctor, "Won't you just help this human being?" And the doctor, he said, "Fuck you," basically. And I guess I want to know who the doctors are, especially. I do know the names of some of the psychologists who were involved in this program, and I've written about them in the book because I find that also incredibly spooky, that there were psychologists involved in this interrogation program, and that it was designed by psychologists. The one that the CIA had was designed in order to cause sort of the psychic demolition of people. And it was based on research that's been done in both in Penn, among other places, and inside the CIA since the Cold War days. There's a lot known about how to really make somebody fall apart, and that it was a very powerful program that was being aimed on these people.
We'll keep going here. Any ladies with their hands up? Lady in the blue back there on our right, about six rows back.
I was just wondering if you could explain, do we lease the land at Guantanamo, or what is...
It's in the book. I'll try to remember. I'm not a lawyer, but basically I think we have a lease in... It's either a 100-year lease or a lease in perpetuity for $1. I think it's in perpetuity. Is that right? Yeah. And so the argument that the administration made was it's not America. But basically the Supreme Court has said over and over, oh, well, it's covered by American law now. So they were certainly looking for a place that no law could reach.
Gentlemen, to your right, Tina.
Just one other thing about that was the first idea they had, which was just daft, I thought, was to put people on boats and have the merchant marine vessels that are leased by the CIA and have them just perpetually circumnavigate the globe. So that way they would always be outside of any kind of known legal system. So.
Hi. I just want to say that I thought your book was beautifully written.
Thank you.
And
not too depressing.
So well, one of the questions I wanted to ask, I think one of the differences with Watergate is that the media has changed and that the country is divided now, and one half has tuned out the other half, and media has been created to feed the information to each side.
Mm-hmm.
So my question to you then, I think all of us here, you know, you're preaching to the choir, we admire what you've done. So what are you doing to reach out to the other side and to try to subvert the great unwashed, you know?
No, everything I can. I mean, I have been going on some of these talk shows, as I said, the one that I was on yesterday where the guy said basically, you know, it would work on me, why shouldn't we do it to them? And it's a difficult argument. I mean, the thing is, what I've tried to do in this book and in talking about this is explain this isn't, torture's not an issue about Democrats versus Republicans. It's an issue about understanding American ideals that we all share. And I think to some extent there's ignorance about it. And so because of shows like 24, where people think that torture is going to get you, you know, save you in 1 hour show. And so what I've tried to do to reach across the partisan divide is to remind people of the truth, which is it's the U.S. military that objected first to this program, which is not usually considered a bastion of liberalism. And it was the FBI that laid down the law and said, we aren't going there. What you're doing is criminal. And we actually believe in the laws of this country. And it's Republican lawyers in the administration who withdrew those torture memos and lost their jobs. And so I think if people understand that it's been a tradition in America since George Washington that when you take somebody prisoner in a war, you treat them humanely, because if you don't, you're a barbarian, and it dishonors soldiers as much as anyone else. I think when they understand that these are values that go to the, you know, they're so part of the ethos of the military and of law enforcement that it's really not a particularly liberal or conservative thing. It's a very American thing. So I'm hoping to try to reach out in that direction. I have to say that I, so far, knock on wood, have not gotten clobbered yet by the right wing. There's been sort of radio silence. And I think it's because so many of the sources in this book, even on the record, are their own people. And the heroes, to some extent, are some of their own people. So the American Spectator wrote something slightly snotty today, but that's the first thing I've had from the right wing on this, and the book's been out 3 weeks now.
A few more questions. Gentleman in the multicolored shirt here.
Thank you. In your view, have Bush and Cheney committed impeachable offenses?
Well, I mean, and this is not a dodge. The truth is, I'm not a lawyer, and so I'm not even sure. I think impeachment is as much as anything a political issue, rather than just a legal issue. And so, if the question is, will they be impeached? I'd say, as someone who covers politics in Washington, no. I mean, I don't see a groundswell of outrage on this, and don't want to sound like Bob Dole, but, you know, where's the outrage? It's not happening right in Washington right now. Were they war criminals is another question that people ask a lot. And, you know, the Red Cross report that I describe in this book says that this program, which was purposely set up by the United States government from the very top of the White House, constituted torture. And torture is a war crime. So, you know, it certainly they're in a danger zone there, but to make somebody a war criminal, you've got to prosecute them. And this Justice Department is not going to be prosecuting these people, if you want to be practical about it. So, you know, Philippe Sands, an international lawyer, said that who actually was involved in the prosecution of Pinochet, said that he thought it was more probable that some tap on the shoulder would come for somebody like Rumsfeld in Europe or someplace else. Maybe even Spain seems to be the most likely place that might sort of push this. But I just, as someone who covers politics, don't see it happening here.
Yeah, I thought you had mentioned in the book that somebody was that there were several people who were advised not to travel outside the country who were in this war council cabal.
They're all the way through. I think that's striking how many times the people in this administration were told by their own lawyers this might be criminal. They simply did not listen because they thought they could rewrite the laws and that they held the Justice Department.
Okay, a few more questions. Gentleman in white all the way in the back row there, and then we'll take somebody on this side.
Yes. What you say earlier today was inflation, fear, and something else was created by fools when politics get the best of us, we correct them.
Anxiety and fear exploited by zealots and fools. That's what Zelico said, yeah.
That's when we correct the politics, right?
I'm sorry?
That's when we correct the politics?
That's what he said about how we wound up embracing torture as a country.
Yeah, because I was looking at Al Gore's point of view of it. Like in that movie, The Inconvenient Truth.
Sir, do you have a specific question you want to ask, and then we'll address that?
About the movie?
No. What question do you want to ask, Ms. Mayor?
What? That was already a question.
What Al Gore thought of it, I don't know. He's written a book where he really has said that he thinks this is a tragic desecration of the Constitution. And though I've got to say something interesting to me was that in 2004 during the presidential campaign, John Kerry, as far as I know, never even uttered the word Guantanamo, but the pictures of Abu Ghraib had come out in April of 2004. And so, again, when you're thinking about why hasn't this been like Watergate, the Democratic Party did not take this on, and again, he thought it was a dangerous spot to be in for a politician to be opposing these policies. And the reason he thought that was because the public hasn't taken a strong stand. So, gets back to why I was ending with Ben Franklin. You know, it's a republic. If you can keep it, you have to speak up on these things if you care about them.
Lady right here, about 10 rows back with her hand up. Could you keep your hand up, please? Could you keep your hand up, please? We'll get you the mic.
Oh, I don't need the mic. I don't like mics. But I blame the American public also. I really prefer to stand up because I blame myself. We knew the war was wrong. We knew the torture was wrong. We all saw those pictures. But I'm not hearing anything about the press. Am I supposed to believe Tim Russert? Who do I believe? And why didn't I hear more in the press? Do you discuss this among yourselves?
No, I think the press was somewhat cowed also in much the way the politicians were. And this is not to excuse any of them. But I also think... maybe because I used to be a newspaper reporter and I think it's too easy to beat up on the press, that there are some reporters who have done just a fabulous job on this story. Dana Priest at the Washington Post. You have no idea how hard it is to get these stories. I mean, it takes digging and digging and digging, and you become the subject, as she was and I was, of a leak investigation, where you know that anybody you talk to is in danger of becoming contaminated by the leak investigation, too. Nobody wants to talk to you then. And it's a very chilling atmosphere in Washington. But the New York Times, James Risen's stories on the NSA program were quite amazing. And Bart Gellman's pieces in the Washington Post on Cheney, he and a reporter named Joe Becker, who's now at the Times, there's been some just superb reporting done on this. But it takes a lot of time. I don't know what the Inquirer is doing because I don't see it. But it takes a lot of time, so it's very expensive for news organizations because, you know, you just got to dig. What was what correct?
Isn't that wrong? And I myself feel so discouraged. What do I watch? I don't
get a CBS and a CABC. It's been a print story more than a television story. And I think and the pictures that you're seeing of the war are very censored. TV has a much harder time with a complicated story like this. But you've got to read, the best newspapers in the country have covered it. The Wall Street Journal was the first to get the torture memo, and TV was much bolder in the Vietnam War, I think. The living room war, they called it.
Yeah, there's been a shift in coverage. Gentleman right here, about 10 rows back.
Thank you. I think it's also worth noting that the New Yorker had some terrific articles by a whole number of journalists.
This is my college friend, David Paul.
Oh, see, now that's not fair.
The shill in the audience.
Well, and because of that, I can ask you... So when you said that Rumsfeld got tapped, would get tapped on the shoulder, were you personally disappointed that he seems to have played such a small role in all of this?
You mean in the book or in the program?
As you said in the book, he doesn't do detainees.
Oh,
and
he said he doesn't.
It seemed as though he insulated himself fairly well.
He did, but his lawyer, Jim Haynes, the top lawyer in the Pentagon, was also up to his ears in this, and very close with Cheney and Addington. It was really a small cabal of people. At one point, one of the lawyers says, and he's again a top Republican lawyer in the White House, said he was sitting there watching this little cabal as they were making these policies, and he thought to himself, how did these lunatics ever get control of the United States? And it is really a phenomenal story, I think. I can't convey to you how weird it was inside that place and how intimidating it was for anybody who opposed these policies. I mean, they were bullied and humiliated, and their careers were ended. And, you know, I mean, and certainly that's the price you pay. But there is a scene in the book where two of the top lawyers in the administration, including the number two man at the Justice Department, Jim Comey, who's the Deputy Attorney General of the United States, he and Jack Goldsmith, who runs the Office of Legal Counsel, resort to talking in codes because they think that they might be being wiretapped, and they also feel like they might actually be in physical danger because they're trying to oppose Cheney's office on torture. So, I mean, it was just an extraordinary and weird environment in there.
A few more gentlemen in the yellow right here.
Was it a possibility that some of the muted criticism in Washington was caused by personal intimidation, people believing that if they opposed too loudly, they might find themselves in incommunicado in Guantanamo?
Well, I don't think that it was the fear of Guantanamo, but it was the fear of being described as anti-American and pro-terrorist that put them on notice. And it was also the fear of one of the things when we were talking earlier about President Bush's performance in this and what he did know and didn't know, I'm told that he was frequently intimidated in a way in discussions in the White House by Cheney and even sometimes Gonzalez, people who would say to him, you know, the blood will be on your hands. If there's another attack, it's going to be on you, and you've got to do everything you can to protect America. If he was faltering or wavering on these programs, they very much put him on the spot. And one of the people I interviewed, who's another Republican lawyer, said, right, he was on the spot, but it's the role of the president to say, okay, the buck stops with me, this is wrong, I'm not doing it. And he never said that. And so according to Colin Powell, Cheney really knew how to play the president, and basically Powell's quote to a friend was that he claimed the president's not a dumb man, but he said that he can be easily manipulated by Cheney because Cheney knows that the president always wants to do what's portrayed as the hard thing. So, you know, Cheney will say, you know, this is tough, it's a tough decision, and, you know, you could go the easy way or you could do the hard thing, and the hard thing is always the one that the president's going to pick. So...
right here in the white. Sir, could you wait for the mic, please?
I wanted to follow up with one of the questions raised before. Obviously, McCain is not going to do anything about this as president, and I don't think Obama will either because his purported attorney general, Cass Sunstein, the law professor, said we're not going to do anything except about egregious crimes. So I think it's going to be like what you said Curry is going to do. I think this is the end of the road.
What? Who's going to do? I didn't hear that. It's going to be like what had to do?
What? As you described Curry not wanting to do anything, it's clear that Obama is not going to do anything.
I don't know if that's true. I mean, there's been, you know, I do think that the first step, and I actually want to do some writing and some more reporting on this to try to figure out. The first step, I would think, would be to figure out what records can be gotten. And, you know, I think the more people know, the more outraged they'll be. I mean, there have been a lot of lies from the top of the administration about this program, including the lie that this is not torture and that this always works and that we had to do this and that there was no dissent on this. You know, there's a whole counter narrative here that's got to be understood and gotten out, and the records have to be gotten out. So, I think you could probably count on McCain to certainly end the program that the CIA has and that the military has that includes real torture. I think you can count on Obama, who's a constitutional law professor, to believe in checks and balances again, maybe, and also to get rid of the most coercive aspects of this. But people are talking about truth commissions, some kind of bipartisan thing. You know, it sounds wussy, but actually the 9/11 Commission did a pretty good job of getting to the bottom of things. They didn't draw any radical conclusions, but it's a hell of a record they compiled if you go through it carefully, it's incredibly damning about what this Bush administration knew and didn't act on before 9/11. Just take somebody, you know, going through and analyzing it. So I would hope that there'll at least be something like that. I don't know.
We shall see. This book is a hell of a record of what happened. I'd highly recommend that you read it. Please join me in thanking Jane Mayer.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.